danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 273 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Catonsville, Maryland, I'm Andrew Brokus, joined by Nate Mavis in Melrose, Massachusetts. How are you doing since the last time we spoke, Nate?
Just fantastic. Never better. Never better. How about you?
Also very good. Nothing terrible has happened to me in the last minute.
Glad to hear.
We sometimes record more than one of these intros at once. Our guest today is... I always never remember how to ask people how to pronounce their last names. I'm going to guess Paul Rundy. And Paul is someone I met when I was in Bend, Oregon. You may have seen on Twitter, I was talking some about playing in the Bend. Actually, I guess I talked about it on the podcast as well. Paul and his wife, Leanne, own and operate the Bend Poker Room. And this is really unlike anywhere else that I've played poker before. And I think this is related to the fact that we were able to get Paul to talk to us in a way that a lot of people working in, you know, casino poker rooms for a variety of reasons just don't have a lot of incentive to do at least the kind of interview that we would want to do. You know, that was something more than just kind of purely promotional. There's a lot of stuff that if you work for like a big corporate casino that you just for various reasons can or are not incentivized to talk about.
Yeah, our social media policy prevents me from calling any of our customers a shitbag on
a
podcast.
But so this is like a mom and pop poker room, which is there's just not really a whole lot of that sort of thing around. I've played in one or two rooms actually that were even smaller than this one, but this room it has something like 12 poker tables in it. It's in a strip mall. It's just, you know, one couple that kind of runs the place, and they have some drinks and stuff that you can buy. They have some snacks. Actually, I mean, I before I went there, I thought that the drinks and food were going to be a bigger part of their business model. I was actually kind of surprised how little they had. And there's no like meal food there. You can order food, and in fact, Leanne went and picked up food for us once. But yeah, they don't actually sell as much as I would have thought that they would sell. And the way this works, and it's related to Oregon's laws about gambling and poker, is it's a club. So you pay $10 at the door, and then there's no rake, there's no professional dealers. The players actually take turns dealing, which was a new experience for me. And we talked some to Paul about that and you know the obvious questions related to that. The players deal. There, you can play as long as you want. There's no one's taking a rake. There's no tipping the dealers. They have tournaments. They have cash games. It seems like mostly no limit hold'em. They do have a PLO 8 game that goes there sometimes. I think they have some maybe regular 08 that happens sometimes as well. Angela Jordison is a regular there, someone you may have heard on this podcast before. She's actually the one who, you know, told me that this place existed and encouraged me to go there, and I'm glad that she did because I doubt I would have found it on my own. Even if I did find it on my own, I might not have sought it out just because the stakes there aren't really that high. But it was definitely an interesting and a fun place to play. And I wanted to give you that idea of it just so that you can appreciate, you know, some of what we're talking to Paul. And, you know, we'll talk a lot about the business of running a poker room, which we've never really had the chance to talk to someone about before. But I wanted to give you a sense of what kind of poker room this is.
Yeah. Great interview. Big fan. Really enjoyed it.
Oh, it's helpful, too, that Paul, I guess, is a listener and was a listener to the show even before I went to the Bend Poker Room. So I guess he probably had an idea of what we would be looking for in an interview. But I thought he did a great job, and I'm grateful to him for talking to us.
Heartily seconded.
Our strategy segment is coming up now, but if you want a lot more strategy, and I mean a lot more, like hundreds of hours more, head over to tournamentpokeredge.com. For as little as $25 a month, You can get access to their full library, thousands of videos from dozens of instructors, including me. Check it out for yourself at tournamentpokeredge.com. This is an interesting strategy question we have today, because I was actually at the table where this occurred, although I was not a significant part of the hand. It's coming to us from Carrie. She says, I'm writing about a hand that played out this summer at a tournament table where Andrew is sitting, along with Annette Oberstadt and Maria Konnikova, former podcast guest. It was an $1,100 buy-in tournament at the Wynn. And I actually remember this table quite distinctly because I was wondering to myself whether I'd ever played at a table that was majority female before. And in all the time that I've been playing poker, I'm not sure. And this happened. So we had there were four women at the table, including this woman, Carrie, who's writing to us. And at one point, the table was seven-handed. So at that time, it was actually a majority female table. And I was kind of debating whether, I'm thinking that I have not ever experienced that before in all my time playing, but at least not, I mean, obviously online, I don't know, but live poker, I don't think I'd ever experienced that before.
Yeah, I remember one time. It was at the 40-80 mix at the Wynn, at the Bellagio back in the day. It was after Badoogie got introduced, but before all the wacky games got introduced. It was like, you know, like 08-ish. Mm-hmm. So it would have been like Triple Draw and 08 and Badoogie and what, maybe Stud High Low Regular. And it was five eighths female. I remember. And I still remember it 10 years later. So,
yeah, it was, everyone was commenting on it. It certainly it was a new experience, I think, for most of the women at the table as well. I mean, many of them have probably played the women's event, but aside from that, it was. Yeah. So Carrie says, I'm a middle-aged woman, i.e. I have a tight image. If people were paying attention, they wouldn't have characterized me as passive, but probably more tight with middling aggression. And as someone who was paying attention and was at the table, I can confirm that. It was fairly early stage, 300, 600, she says 50, but this would have been a big blind ante tournament. I think it was actually 300, 600, 600. Annette, Andrew, and to a certain extent Maria had been playing a fairly conservative game, picking decent spots and not splashing around much. That part I'm going to disagree with. I would say Annette had been splashing around a fair bit, as Annette is wont to do. But yeah, I would not describe Annette's play as having been conservative at that table or in general. Continuing with Carrie's words, in seat three was a very loose, aggressive South American who was throwing around a lot of chips without much rhyme or reason, trying to muscle players out of pots with limited success. In seat nine was a woman I know from California. She is an erratic, loose, aggressive player. I've seen her crush tables, but also make some really strange and low EV moves, in my humble opinion. The way I played this hand was informed by my knowledge of her style of play. Stack sizes were not wildly disparate at this point. The lag in seat 4 had about 16k and was the shortest stack. I had about 19k. Everyone else in the hand was 22 to 25k neighborhood. I was in the small blind with ace-queen of hearts. Annette opened under the gun 1 to 1500. The South American under the gun 2 called, and either Andrew or Maria called. Sorry, I don't recall which one, but it quickly becomes irrelevant. I called in the small blind, being out of position, being out of position with ace queen suited against three or four players. I had no desire to inflate the pot or open up betting for a four bet, but I was not prepared to fold preflop. All right, so let's pause.
Hey, there, Nate, can you think of a play that's really good when your opponents are splashing around too much and you're not prepared to fold preflop? Yeah, I think this is a pretty clear jam. So under the gun opens, and then there are two calls, and there are some blinds and antes in the pot. There's like 45, it's like 6K in the pot, roughly. More like 7,500 after your call. And then you have to shove like 19K more. I would shove 19K more. I would bet all your chips. Somebody beats you, they beat you. I would go all in. It's a good play.
Yeah, I think going all in is an option. I also think making a more, making a smaller squeeze with the intention of calling a shove is also an option. I suppose you could even leave out the option of folding if somebody cold four bets. I don't think I would fold to a four bet from Annette or anyone else who flatted Annette's raise in the first place, but I guess I could imagine if I made it, say, so 1500 call, if I made it like 7,000. Even then, that's like a 30-year stack. Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's pretty hard to find a squeeze size that's not committing your stack. And she only.
What did
had,
I say?
She said
Andrew,
she had
what did
19.
I say?
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right.
I mean, it gets different if. It matters a little bit that the second caller is a good player who's not just going to say like, "Ah, I've got reverse implied odds." King 10 suited isn't a calling hand. I'm going to fold for just a tiny little click it 3-bet. You know, like if you're against exactly those players, you can consider a smaller squeeze size. But you're not. I would put all my chips in, then either win a nice pot or go get a meal.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think this relates to it feels early in the tournament. We've only been playing for a couple of hours, and it was a reentry tournament. Obviously, not everyone who plays reentry tournaments actually plans to reenter, but reentry was still open. But I know people will have a preference sometimes for not wanting to play big pots relatively early in tournaments, or not wanting to lose all their chips relatively early in tournaments, or something like that. But really, you only have 33 big blinds, something like that, right now, 32 big blinds. You're not really that deep. As you said, Nate, there is a lot of money in the pot already. It's quite unlikely that a hand better than ace-queen is out there. I mean, the people calling are very unlikely to have hands better than ace-queen. Obviously, Carrie and I had somewhat of different opinions on how Annette is playing, but just the simple fact that she raised an early position, I mean, that by itself, I don't think is... still plenty of reasons why ace queen could be good, even if Annette were playing more conservatively than she actually was. And ace queen's not doing terribly, even if it gets all in preflop against like pocket kings. You're still in pretty okay shape.
I mean, you can also you can get called and then win unimproved. That's a thing that can happen. A lot of good things can happen. And again, if you lose, even if you don't want to re-enter, you're on Spring Mountain, you're at the win, you can just go to Chinatown, get a lovely meal. It's like re-entering, but it's like $1,090 cheaper, and you get really good Chinese food. So, it's great. It's great. I love going all in here. It's a good play.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Carrie continues. So after Carrie calls in the small blind with her ace-queen of hearts, and then she says, the player to my left in the big blind, this is the woman that she described as somewhat erratic and aggressive, raised to 5,500. Given my prior knowledge of her, I did not put her on a monster hand. I thought she was trying to squeeze, albeit with a less than ideal bet size. Everyone except C3 had been playing pretty tight, so I think big blind figured she could induce folds, even with a smaller bet. Annette called, the next two players folded, and the betting was on me. The pot was 1350 plus 6,000 plus 9,500, so about 17K in the pot. And Carrie says, if I folded, I had less than 30 big blinds, but a slow structure that gave me some time to recover. Folding was a decent option, especially out of position against tough opposition. Calling didn't seem to make a lot of sense to me because it would leave me with 12K behind, and against two players, most flops wouldn't be that conducive to a post-flop shove. I didn't have enough chips to 4-bet without shoving, so the question for me was, should I fold or shove? Due in part to history and in part to my read, I was pretty sure I was in good shape against the big blind. I was concerned about Annette, but I figured if she had jacks or better, she would have 4-bet, so I was flipping with her to most of her range, except ace-king. Given my tight image, though, I thought a preflop shove for 18K could probably induce a fold for many of her mid to lower pairs, her suited combos, and her Broadway cards, and a shove without a call was essentially a double up for me. Anything you want to comment on in there?
So first, when it comes to calling, you don't have to have a ton of great plays all the time post-flop to make calling good. You're getting such a good price that even if you can make a good play sometimes, then you should still call. Just remember your pot odds. Always remember your pot odds.
Yeah, I'm just imagining, if she had, Jack-10 suited here, that's a hand I could see calling with rather than shoving. And, it's going to flop a little bit better. Well, not better, but, there's somewhat more flops that it's going to hit, I guess, than ace-queen suited. But, I wouldn't take calling off the table here, just across the board.
Yep. I also think that Annette, is smart and has played a lot of poker and will always remember her pot odds. So if you shove in the lady in the big blind folds and it gets to Annette, don't expect to fold out pocket sevens. She knows what her pot odds are, and all of us who have played tournaments have seen people shrug and move all in, And I think there's a good chance she will not put you on a monster. I think she will put you on a hand that does not want to play post-flop out of position with a low SPR. And you know what? It makes sense not to want to play out of position with a low SPR. It makes more sense to get all the money in now. I would shove.
Yeah, and I think part of the value of shoving, even aside from... there may be fold equity in you know, getting one of these players to fold, or you're just going to be putting in a lot of money from ahead. Like, I just don't think ace-queen suited is beat very often here. You know, as she says, it sounds like the big blind doesn't need a great hand. I mean, I don't know that I would say the big blind can't have a strong hand, but it sounds like the big blind is, you know, capable of doing something like this with something less than a monster hand, and maybe there's even some kind of sizing tail involved here where she thinks the big blind would have, you know, made a bigger raise if she actually had kings or something. Yeah, I just, you know, it's very unlikely that ace queen is beat. So it's just kind of like when you shove, it's win-win. You know, either people call with hands that are worse than yours, or they fold hands that have live equity. Like, either way, that's a win. And yeah, I mean, I think I certainly wouldn't want to fold when you like. So I guess she says, what did she say? Yeah, she said folding was a decent option. I guess that's the thing I would disagree with the most. I really don't think that you want to fold here. It's true that, you know, you have room to recover in a low structure or something like that, but, I mean, none of that's a reason. Like, I think this is a very profitable spot. You need about 33% equity to put the money in here, and I think you could easily have more than 50%. So I think, you know, folding would be, although it's true that you could kind of, you still have like a playable stack or something like that, I mean, you'd be passing up a lot of value by folding here. So I think it's good that you chose not to do that, Carrie. Yeah, and I guess I agree with shoving. Is there anything more to say about this?
No, but I really like how much of her reasoning Casey is making, yeah, is making explicit. So I mean, I think it sounds like I'm just saying, like, oh, you said, you know, X, Y, and Z, and X is false, and Y is false, and Z is false, but, you know, she also said a lot of things that are not false, and she really put her reasoning out there, and that is how you get better. So, yeah, kudos for that.
Yeah, and she's considering all of her options, which is awesome. You know, at every point, she's kind of, even if it might seem trivial to say, well, of course we're not going to fold, you know, it's still, it's good to actually gut check those things and actually cross them off. Right? I would say, you know, I try to do this routinely, you know, even in situations where I'm like, 90% sure what I'm going to do. If the pot is at all large, you know, I'm going to take a second to consider the other options, and, you know, maybe like one time out of 20 or something like that, you know, I'll be like, oh, actually, maybe that has more merit than I gave it credit for, you know, or, you know, probably not that often do I do something different, but, you know, maybe one time out of like 50, I decide to do something other than what I thought was the obvious play before I forced myself to consider the other options.
And that's a lot.
Okay, results. Carrie says, I shoved, big blind quickly called, and Annette folded, so we did have some fold equity here. Big blind turned over king queen offsuit, the board ran out, giving her a straight and knocking me out. She asked for our analysis of the big blind's play as well, which I don't know, I'm a little reluctant to do. I think a lot of times people want to ask this. Like, I think it's not a coincidence that she lost the pot and then wants to know our opinion of Big Blind's play. I mean, I don't think it's great, but I also think it's really not the thing that you want to worry about. You know, you want to focus on getting a lot of decisions right yourself. And, you know, I think it's to your credit that you did get the decision to get the ace-queen suited in when you had the opportunity. And in fact, I would say, I mean, obviously you're not going to feel gratitude exactly to the big blind since you end up getting eliminated by her, but to some degree you were sort of lucky that the big blind reopened the betting for you and enabled you to get this in, you know, pre-flop, rather, which ended up being a very good spot for you. You know, depending on the stack sizes involved, like, it might have made sense for the big blind to just shove in the same, yeah. For a lot of the same reasons that it made sense, you know, for you to shove, as we said. And I think particularly, you know, if she has a similar stack size, I think king queen is also not a terrible hand to just shove here. I do think, you know, three betting and then calling it off is a lot less good than shoving, even if she ends up having the right price once she faces the shove. The big problem with that small three bet is, you know, what almost ended up happening, which is that, you know, she ends up getting multiple calls from hands that would have folded if she had made the larger raise. Like, clearly Annette didn't have a hand that she was going to get all in with preflop, but you make a tiny squeeze, and like you said, Annette's going to recognize her pot odds. So I think that's actually the bigger mistake, rather than just, you know, getting it in preflop at all with king queen. I don't think that part's so terrible.
Yeah, and I want to say this is part of playing at the World Series. So in this specific hand, Casey knew this big blind. But I think had I been observing this hand, I would have thought something like, oh, you know, somebody who 3-bet with the king-queen and then called it off, this is somebody who either A, last studied poker like 4 years ago, or B, has a home game where people fold to the tiny squeezes, because like expecting people to fold for this is something that might have made sense 4 to 12 years ago, and doesn't make a lot of sense at a Win 1100 today. Fair, yes?
Yeah, I think so. At least given the people involved. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to pick up the pot entirely pre-flop. I mean, I think sometimes people don't always have even that clear of a plan, and they're just sort of like, oh, I like my hand, I'll put a little more money in the pot.
Oh, sure, sure. But the idea that this could be like a squeeze from somebody who's tokening the word squeeze in her mind as she's doing this is, you know, I it's just something about going to Las Vegas where you get these plays that are either outdated or like, oh, somebody is used to being in a basement in Wyoming where this works a lot, and it's not. And you know, similarly for me, I, you know, this works at Foxwoods maybe, or like this is how people play over here. And it's just part of what you have to realize when you sit down at a tournament that's drawing people from everywhere, is that other people play different from how you play.
Yeah, but I do think it's an important point about the pot odds involved here, and the possibility of having fold equity on a shove that, you know, not only should Carrie be shoving the ace queen suited, but quite possibly the player in the big blind could profitably shove king queen. I mean, so the tricky thing there is like there is a lot more value in just calling with king queen offsuit also, because she's getting a really good price on doing that, and depending on how she chooses to value her turn, like I think that's a closer decision. But I think even just, you know, jamming the king queen wouldn't be unreasonable, which should illustrate something about how profitable it would be to jam the ace queen suited in Carrie's shoes. Thanks very much for writing, Carrie. It was a pleasure playing with you. Thank you for being part of the perhaps only female majority table I've ever played at. It was certainly an enjoyable experience, more social than a typical table, and there were some, I would say, some funny and fair jokes made at the expense of the average male poker player, as people were commenting on the dynamic. I hope you enjoyed the rest of your time in Las Vegas. Oh, and she said she's a former debate geek, so props on that as well. Thanks for listening, thanks for writing, and thanks everyone else for listening. Enjoy our interview with Paul Rundy? Rundy. I'll start by thanking you for your hospitality to me. As you know, I enjoyed playing at the Ben Poker Room, and I thought that you and Leanne did a really nice job of making it a fun and a welcoming place to play.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, we enjoyed having you there.
How long have you been playing poker?
Oh, wow. Well, I played when I was in middle school, that kind of thing, but for this run, I would say probably around 05 or 06.
So around the start of the boom.
Oh, yeah. I distinctly remember on there was a Thanksgiving where the football game wasn't very good, and the Travel Channel was having a marathon of the World Poker Tour, and we watched that all day.
Nice.
That was kind of the start.
What made you want to open your own poker room?
Leanne and I moved to Oregon to build a house, and while we were doing it, we were working as school bus drivers. It was a good part-time job, had benefits and so forth, and that had all kind of come, we had moved into the house and that stuff, and so I was just looking for something else to do, and honestly, I was on a field trip, and I was started doing a spreadsheet about running a poker room. The room we had in Bend had closed, and every time I looked at the spreadsheet, I kept thinking, wow, this is a pretty good idea. So I just needed something to do. Obviously my school bus driving days were over. I was happy about that. And it just seemed like a good idea and a good time to go for it. It was certainly a kind of a perfect storm in Bend. The place we had closed and had been closed almost a year. So there was a lot of pent-up demand to have a place to play for sure. So
when it was a good time. The place that we had, was that the one that Angela Jordison opened?
No, she was previous to that. Poker went through several different places in Bend. The last place was a sports bar. It's really kind of a similar operation to what we do, except they had a restaurant. But they didn't charge a door fee. They had a different model. And what ended up happening was they didn't make as much money off poker players as they anticipated. And they ended up just deciding to stop poker altogether.
Hashtag NickCast.
Yeah.
So what's your business model? I mean, I talked about this a little bit on the show, but I might have gotten the details wrong and people may not have heard it. I mean, there's a lot that makes your room unique relative to certainly anywhere else I've ever played poker. I guess there's a few other maybe somewhat similar, you know, places elsewhere, but
yeah. So Oregon has a social gaming ordinance, which the intent, I believe, when it was first written was to allow you to play poker at your country club or play poker in a bar, that kind of thing. And people in Oregon sort of seized on that. The idea is that it's fundamentally different than a casino. A casino is taking a percentage of all bets in all games. So I guess the equivalent in poker is raking the pot. The idea in Oregon is 100% of the money that the players wager has to go back to the players. So there's no rake, there's no tipping dealers, you just pay a door fee, and then we encourage you to buy drinks and snacks, of course.
And also you say no tipping dealers, but at least in your room, and I my understanding is elsewhere in Oregon, maybe they're not quite as strict, at least in adhering to the spirit of the law, but you know, in your room, there really are no professional dealers, and it's a player-dealt game, which is the first time I'd experienced that for real money.
Yeah, it's... So the rooms in Oregon, everybody... Well, first off, Portland, Eugene, they have their own city ordinance, so they operate... The state ordinance is very general. Theirs are a little more specific about what they can and can't do. A lot of the rooms have provided dealers. They've called them quote-unquote volunteer dealers. They sort of get in trouble for doing that, and then they come to an agreement with the city, and they go back. There are rooms like ours that are player-dealt. And in Central Oregon, we had done player-dealt rooms really going back a pretty long time. You know, the place before us, which was had poker for 4 or 5 years, that was all player dealt. So for us, it was an easy transition to just have player dealt games. When people come from out of town, their eyebrows kind of raise when they hear, but it works out fine for the most part.
I was such a player.
Yeah.
I think you heard me talk about it a little on the air. I imagine you think my concerns are overblown?
No, not at all. I wouldn't want to play for a lot of money in a player-dealt game either. Although, typically for our games, when it's the bigger games, you have our more experienced players. I mean, Angela's a good example of that. And they are very... they're just on top of it, you know. These are more experienced poker players, and I think those issues are pretty well insignificant.
I will say I'm a pretty experienced poker player, and I'm not at all confident that I would catch someone, bottom dealing, for instance.
Well, not so much in that regard. Is that it's? I mean, that's certainly an issue as well. And we have caught a few cheaters in our time. Who are no longer welcome. But it's also the communal nature. Like, we had an issue with marking cards or crimping cards or that kind of thing. And I remember giving it was the Omaha game specifically, which you played, got to play in a little, a brand new setup, and 30 minutes the cards had some crimps, and you know, we sat there saying, all right, who in this game is cheating? all 10 of those people have known each other for 10 years or more and played together for 10 years or more. So obviously nobody in that game is trying to cheat each other.
Mm-hmm. So what, it was just somebody was handling the cards roughly? I mean, did you?
Yeah. You know, we spent so much time on that and we could never figure it out. And so then we started, I actually had Leanne go through a deck and do it. If you do it with the cards face up, you tend to notice the significant cards that are crimped. So I had Leanne do it with the cards face down. And it, after a night of play, it was like, I believe it was 23 cards in the deck. And it was completely random cards out of the deck. And that pretty much everybody's like, all right, this obviously somebody's not trying to cheat. They're just not good at being kind to the cards they have, I guess.
Have you considered using different cards?
Yeah, we have, and we've tried different cards at times, and usually they get a bad review only because people are used to what we have. We use Copac cards, mm-hmm. and they've been fine, and we've stuck with them, and we really haven't had many issues around that. We occasionally get somebody who will, you know, feel the cards and think something's up, but it's pretty rare.
Yeah. So this gets to a deeper issue in game security and such, which is that you have two of your many goals as a card room operator are A, to keep your customers happy in the short term, and B, to prevent the sort of catastrophic stuff that will make them very unhappy in the long term or present existential risks to your business in the long term. And this is a nice example of that, where you try to use cards that don't get marked, and then people complain because, like, they're used to a different shade of red. if I imagine myself running a room, that would be, like, a huge source of potential frustration for me. How do you address that kind of trade-off?
Well, there's one other element there, is that the regular players... they want to see the room succeed. So there's a bit of a, I'm not the only voice in the wilderness.
Right.
Saying it needs to be this or that. So many, many of the players have the room's best interests at heart.
Yeah.
And I basically have addressed it by asking for feedback at all times.
Yeah.
I sometimes regret that, of course, but for the majority of time, you know, it's funny. I used to always tell Leanne, and one of the beauties of poker is if you have an opinion about something, you can say it. And as a card room operator, that it has its moments. Let's put it that way. But the community, I mean, it really is. For example, my cousin used to always ask me, "Well, what?" And you guys can appreciate this. If somebody gets really mad when they, you know, lose a big pot, what happens? And I say, well, they might get really mad, but they have eight people at the table looking at them like, you know, come on, dude, we've all been there.
Yeah.
And so there is a little bit of a community aspect that helps control a lot of those things.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that also, like, I really appreciate what you said about dealing, like pitching the cards. And I guess the number one argument I would give in favor of self-dealt games is that, like, if you're not alert, even when there's a professional dealer, like, you're putting yourself at enormous risk. So it's like pretending that a risk isn't there doesn't protect you from it. You shouldn't be playing high stakes poker if you don't have a sensitivity to these things. And it's nice that, you know, self-dealing gets that out in the open and may do more to enforce good dealing habits than other systems.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think that our players have a little bit more of a responsibility to the game, because they know they're going to take their turn in the dealer box, and they know that they're thinking about dealing, and they're thinking about how the game goes, and they're watching other people deal and seeing what they do, and this is good, that is bad. So yeah, it sort of creates more responsibility to the game than just sitting there having a paid person that's going to take care of everything.
Yeah. Does this affect your view on other things, like, I don't know, like school boards, governance, generally, things like that?
Well, poker's, and I'm sure you guys appreciate this, it's affected my view on everything. I see things a lot more as probabilities. I see things more as everything's a calculated risk. You know, I mean, even over opening the poker room, I don't think we would have done it before I had played poker, because I wasn't comfortable with, you know, putting a bunch of money in the pot and sometimes you lose it.
Yeah.
And essentially, when you start a business, that's exactly what you're doing. You know, you're trying to pick a spot where you're a heavy favorite when you open. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know if that answered your question. But, yeah, it definitely poker's affected how I look at everything.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate it.
From your description, and I was thinking of asking a similar question to Nate's, I would think it might, I mean, I don't know what your, you know, political leanings are or were, but that it might make you somewhat more libertarian to kind of see, I would argue that the Bend Poker Room is it's not entirely libertarian, but when you talk about, you know, players sort of like taking responsibility for handling a lot of these things on their own and recognizing that they're, even though they're not officially part of the like governance of the room, that, you know, functionally the governance of the room does rely a lot on just sort of a culture among the players, and it works pretty well doing that.
Yeah, we definitely rely on that. Although I had sent you guys an email talking about the floor person. Without a decent floor person, then there's going to be a lot of trouble, I think, in player dealt games. You need somebody to kind of, well, you need somebody who knows the rules, for one, and especially the current rules, because they do evolve over time. And, having a floor person provides the consistency that a dealer provides in other games.
And how do you address that, I guess? I mean, who's your floor person?
Well, it's me or our staff person if I'm not there. You know, rules come up and procedural things come up pretty regularly. And over time, you're setting a standard for how we're going to handle those. And that it's important. You know, one of my things is I want the players who go from our room to feel totally comfortable in any other room. We have a lot of really recreational players who don't play anywhere else, really. And if they go to vacation in Vegas, I want them to, you know, to go play and feel like it's exactly the same as the game that they're playing in now. So I think the floor person's influence, it's not super overt on any one evening, but over time it really has an impact.
Do you have any examples of that? I mean, have there been issues that have come up that you know were noteworthy?
Well, I don't know about noteworthy, but for example, with recreational players, a really common one in tournaments is talking about the contents of their hand during the hand. Mm. And, you know, the majority of rulings that we make in our room are educational in nature, so to say, hey, you can't do that. And a lot of times people argue and say, you know, I saw it on TV or whatever. And I say, hey, I can show you the rule. I think it's PDA rule 62 or something like that. Or I'll tell them they can Google it. You know, you can Google, you know, TDA rules and you'll find it. But this is the rule. And mostly we give warnings. Sometimes people sit out for a few hands or around. And it's mostly people who don't know. They don't realize that that's a different rule. And a lot of times I'll say, hey, you know, if you want, I'll come back after this hand is over and I'll explain why the rule is like that and that kind of thing. So that's 90% of what we do. Occasionally in cash games, there's a ruling in a big pot that's going to determine who's going to win the pot or not. But they're pretty rare, actually.
What kind of briefing does a new player get? You know, if someone comes into the room and says, "Yeah, I've never played poker in a setting like this before. I've only ever played around my kitchen table." Is there any kind of orientation that you give them?
It's minor. They'll get it pretty quickly as they're playing. But yeah, when a new person comes in, the first thing to do is just to have a little conversation to assess what their poker experience is. So you can gauge what I'm going to, you know, you have about 30 seconds or so, sometimes more, to kind of let them know what they need to know. And if they've only played in home games, or if there's somebody who normally plays at the Commerce and comes here, they get a very different speech. So mostly with a new, like, home game people, it's, you know, players deal. It's your first night in. You don't have to take a turn at dealing. And if there's any questions, call for us. If there's any disputes or any of that kind of stuff, call for us and we'll handle it.
Presumably, for people with certain disabilities, they get exempted from dealing also. I'm thinking of, like, extremely shaky hands.
Yeah, yeah. Anybody, the rule is every able-bodied person takes a turn at dealing. So, and, you know, honestly, when people start out at first, they're slow. That's the biggest issue. And there's two issues. They're slow and they're sloppy. Mm-hmm. So,
I mostly focused on avoiding the latter.
Yeah. Yeah. So what usually happens is they'll deal for 15 or 20 minutes and somebody else will say, hey, I can see you're new. Why don't you let me take over the rest of your turn for dealing? Because they don't want the game to be that slow. Mm-hmm. And then every time they deal, they get a little bit better. I mean, I remember, y'all will appreciate this, when I first started dealing at Rivals, I remember thinking, wow, if the button goes around twice, I've dealt an hour. And then I started to notice, you know, the button to go around twice, I'd look at the clock and I'm like, dang, it's only been 45 minutes. And then I started, you know, getting into like, wow, how many hands can I deal in an hour? Like, can I get over 30? Can I get over 35? You know, so I think it's pretty natural that everybody's skills improve as they deal.
What is there any, like, regulatory constraint on what you can do? Like, if people walk in wanting to play Pot Limit Archie, can they do that?
The regulatory constraints, because the gaming ordinance is so broad, and in fact it was written a long time ago, and a lot of it's kind of nonsensical. So we are kind of in a situation, as long as there's, you know, not complaints and we're operating. I mean, we've been checked out. The city sent the police department out to, you know, check on us, and they determined that everything was fine. So the answer is pretty broad, and we can kind of do what we want to do. And maybe I shouldn't say it that way. That's not accurate. Let's just say it's pretty broad. But yeah, any poker game would be fine.
Yeah, good.
People ask about blackjack occasionally, and there have been places that have done blackjack. You have to have a player be the house.
Yeah.
And I'm like, nah, we're not doing that. I'm not really interested in any game where somebody has an advantage.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you start having people off the street banking blackjack, then as you know, you run into some other issues pretty quickly most of the time, and maybe you want to do that, but maybe you don't, and I wouldn't.
Yeah, no, I'm just not interested in going there, and it's a different vibe, a different group of people that want to do that, and we already have this group so well trained. Why why start in with that?
Yeah, yeah. Just for fun, what's the weirdest ruling somebody in your rooms had to make recently? Just like, wow, just like the craziest spot that's come up.
Oh gosh, I should have thought about this ahead of time.
If you want to, here, I'll let you stall for a second.
Okay.
And say, like, for example, the kind of story I have in mind is like way back in the day at Foxwoods, we wound up playing a hand without antes because, like, this very strange, I mean, I'm not saying that was a good ruling, but just, you know, the dealer had really sort of messed up what happens when, like, somebody goes to the bathroom, and like, the floor just eventually threw up her hands and told us to put the button in seat X and play a hand without antes and then start moving it original as normal. Another sort of uncommon but not unheard of situation is for there to be a big pot and then something to happen and then the dealer to go on tilt for some reason and like half to two-thirds of the deck get exposed while there's a lot of money in the pot and the hands are still alive. So that's always fun.
Yeah.
So has anything sort of goofy like that happened in your room recently?
Well, I'll tell you my favorite story recently. So we have our 1-2 game, and on Fridays we do, it's essentially a 2-5 game that's uncapped. We do $1 and $2 blinds, but it's 1-2-4. I mean, it's straddled every hand and sometimes double straddled. So it gets pretty big. And we have one player who, he likes to stack his chips in a wall that come out from the rail. And so not everybody can see his cards. And he really likes when he gets a lot of chips in front of him, and he buys in deep. So if he wins a few hands, he gets a lot of chips in front of him. So there's been an ongoing issue about, hey, I didn't realize you had a hand, that's why I acted out of turn. And so we have one player who's a recovered addict, and he works with people in recovery all the time. He's a super great guy. The table got into a discussion about where this one player was keeping his cards, and he's like, I'm keeping them right here. Everybody can see him. And two other people said, no, we can't see him when they're there. And, you know, we've talked about this before, and he said, well, nobody ever lets me know. And the person who works with recovery said, hey, look, we're having an intervention right now. and I think this is a time you need to listen to the table. And it just made me laugh. And that's a good example of how the players themselves, you know, they kind of did my job in a way, which is I've told him before, hey, you got to keep your cards where everybody can see them. Yeah, it just made me laugh because intervention was the perfect term for that. And he's been better about that since then.
Just keep coming, whoever you are. Just keep coming.
Yeah. Well, let me say about rulings, the things that I didn't anticipate with them is they're very nuanced. I mean, every situation is a little different. And, you know, there'll be an issue of, well, I thought his hand was folded. And so we get into, well, were his cards in front of his chips, or were his cards protected, and that kind of stuff. And they're like, well, his cards were out from the rail. And I'll say, well, how far out from the rail? And then we get into a discussion about, well, how far out from the rail would it constitute folded cards? Are they in front of the chips? That kind of thing. So rulings are a lot more nuanced than I certainly ever anticipated. And I'm trying to always explain to players. They'll say, well, last time he said this. And I'll say, well, last time was different because of this or that. And so that's by far the most difficult part of the job for me.
And it's the sort of thing where player maturity, like there's really no substitute for player maturity. Like,
yeah.
if like maybe if you're in a big pot, if you see somebody's cards go forward a quarter inch, you shouldn't muck your own cards and think you've won, for example.
yeah.
And a million other things like that. What were you going to say, Andrew? Yeah.
I was going to ask Paul, you know, what have you done? You mentioned, you know, back when you were dealing, how you sort of saw your dealing skills improve over time. What have you done to improve your flooring skills?
Well, you remember the Tommy Angelo article, the evolution of a poker player, how you go through these different phases? Uh-huh. First you're too tight, then you're too loose. If I remember the article right.
Yeah.
Then you learn a bunch of moves, and you're trying those all the time. And then eventually you kind of blend all that together. I think that's pretty apropos for rulings. I mean, at first I was trying to be fair, which kind of sounds weird, but sometimes some things are procedural and somebody messed up. They should have won the pot, but they didn't because they mucked their cards, for example, or something like that. And then I went to really tight, so I was memorizing the TDA, and I was reading Robert's rules, and I was ruling every single thing strictly to the letter of the law. And so the answer to that question is I've spent a lot of time on reading those rules. I got the TDA certification. I went to the TDA summit last summer, which was fascinating. That was really cool. Just, I didn't say a word, but to hear the things that were being discussed was very interesting. And they made a lot of jokes like, and then the player threw out just one chip, and then the whole room would laugh, you know, that kind of thing. It was very funny. yeah, you know, poker people are fun, and I think that had there was 250 people from 60 countries or something like that. And it was quite a group of people. I mean, it was pretty interesting experience. So the answer to the question is I've worked on it, and of course I've gotten a lot more experience, and that's made me a lot better.
Do you think of yourself as having a kind of a philosophy of flooring?
Well, that's an interesting question. If the perfect floor person is right in the center, everybody's going to be somewhere around that. And I lean slightly to the side of forgiveness. I would say that's just my personal nature. You know, it's always like initially I was tempted to say, well, he didn't know any better or those kind of things, right? So now I would say my philosophy is mostly just that it's, for the majority of the time, it's how can I provide the appropriate penalty, but also educate the player so that the same situation doesn't happen again.
Sounds like a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's mostly that. And I, you know, when I don't know something, like, or I'm not sure, I'll say, hey, here's what we're going to do, you know, and I'm going to go look it up, and, you know, we can discuss it on the break or after the hand, that kind of thing. So, and I think my skills have improved. I mean, we've been open a little over 4 years. You know, I got challenged on rulings a lot initially, and probably rightly so. But I think my skills have improved to the point where, you know, people take my word for the vast majority. They might not like it, but they take my word on it.
Yeah. And if you're trying, that goes a long way. I mean, I think any reasonable player, and I mean, players behave unreasonably, but like, I don't know. I've seen a lot of wrong rulings and these things happen. Like the people get upset. Most of the time the people get really upset for the most part is when the floor is just like obviously not trying or just sort of, you know, it's like, I have a view of how poker should be. I'm not keeping up with the times. I'm also not doing things traditionally. It's just like my own, you know, it's like, I'll be golfing in half an hour. There's your ruling, you know, shut up.
Yeah.
Like it. It's
yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, the one thing our philosophy when you opened the room was, I don't know if we'll do a better job than the previous rooms, but I know we're going to try harder.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to make an effort to do the best we can. So yeah, I agree 100%.
When you opened the business, were there other ways that you thought about, how you wanted to be different from the rooms that you had played in?
Yeah. And mostly I was just thinking of the rooms we've had in Central Oregon. Mm-hmm. The majority of them, they were poker and something else. So it was poker in a sports bar or, you know, poker in a restaurant or that kind of thing. So the main thing was if we were going to focus specifically on doing the best job we can at running a poker room. And that was the biggest thing. I initially had thought, you know, we don't charge very much money. I remember you commented about that, Andrew. And it was really Leanne that kind of convinced me, like, just because our price isn't very high, we can provide a better looking room. So we've tried to, in the cheapest ways possible, upgrade the appearance and the just overall atmosphere of the room. And I think that's been pretty successful. Players comment on it. They like it. So we were going to try hard, and we were going to try to over-deliver, basically. I mean, you know, standard business stuff.
Is this your first time owning a business?
It is.
Any surprises there?
Well, you know, it's funny. I tried to get a friend of mine to be an investor. And I had sent him some, you know, spreadsheets and a business plan and all that kind of stuff. And I have business experience, so that was very helpful on that stuff. He's like, man, I don't I don't think you can run this by yourself. But I'm like, what are you talking about? I just sit there at the desk, and then every 45 minutes, somebody will say, hey, I need some chips. You know, it's the easiest thing in the world. And the biggest surprise is it didn't turn out like that at all.
It's a bit like landlording, where people think they just need to show up and collect a check, and then that's not how it is.
Yeah, that's a very good analogy. Yeah, exactly.
So what are these other things that you found yourself doing besides making rulings every 45 minutes?
Yeah. Well, there's everything from, you know, the city and licensing, accounting, the pretty vast amount of connecting with government agencies, you know, licensing and your insurance tax numbers and all this kind of stuff. And then I realized we should have formed an LLC, which we didn't initially. And so switching over from that took a tremendous amount of time. And our payroll company kept getting it wrong. And I was constantly getting letters from the IRS saying, you know, you haven't paid your quarterly tax. So, yeah, just that kind of stuff. Just all the stuff you would imagine that you didn't think of. I used to work for the YMCA, and when we would do a budget for a program, we'd add another 20% for all the stuff we couldn't think of. Mm. And it's the same kind of thing. Like, you know, there's just a whole lot of stuff you can't think of ahead of time. Or at least I couldn't think of ahead of time.
Can I ask if that changed your politics? I did operations for a company once and had to do all that, and I came out of it with different politics. Have you?
Yeah. No, it hasn't. And I'll give you an example. When we were building our house, you know, everybody has this own building codes. It's a giant hassle, you know, blah, blah, blah. They expect a bunch of stuff that's ridiculous. And in my case, after building the house, the fact that somebody who knows what they're doing would come out and look at the electrical wiring and go, yeah, that looks good, or no, you messed this up, you need to change it, I was super happy about that. Because that, you know, I needed the help. I'd never done it before. So I kind of have a view of a lot of those regulations of like, okay, why is this required? And I get why it is. You know, I get why you need a license to sell alcohol. And that you're going to have regular inspections to make sure you're doing it right. That's totally fine with me. So it hasn't really changed my politics, but I certainly could see where it could.
maybe we started off in different places, but that's very useful. And I think your attitude is good. I mean, both because I think it's true and also because it's a great way to keep your sanity if you actually have to do all that paperwork.
Well, I've gradually learned, you know, you can hire people to do a lot of this stuff. So the accountant takes care of a lot of the stuff. The payroll company, heaven forbid if you had to do all that stuff yourself and try to get it right. So as we've been more successful and we've made a little more money, I've been able to hire people to do that stuff, and that helps considerably.
Yeah, I was going to say congratulations for making it 4 years. A lot of card rooms don't, and I'm glad to hear that you're not only successful, but making more money. Like, from a business perspective, are you planning to expand or do something more?
God, no.
Like, yeah. You know, selling more and different things? Like is your... If you close your eyes and picture your room in 2 years, is it roughly what it is now? Just maybe with some more kinks worked out or whatever?
Well, I do have a totally separate idea that I really like, but I don't think will work. But I do like to think about it occasionally. I'll tell you that in a second. But basically, the room, the business model is such that most of the costs are fixed. So our goal is always to get as many players as we can. And as long as we can continue to grow our numbers, you know, then we're going to do pretty well. And so I think our room, we can handle up to 100 players at a time, and we've had that one time, actually. other than having to move to a larger location, which would be fantastic, I think it's going to stay basically the same. I'd like to grow our numbers and maybe have to work a little less hours on the floor. But I really like being there, so I'm not in that, you know, I can't wait till I'm not doing the day-to-day. But it's basically the same.
What's the idea?
So we got a ping pong table. I don't know if we had any ping pong going when you were there, Andrew, but
I definitely saw the table. I don't remember if anyone was playing.
Well, when we first got it, I was stunned by how many people like to play ping pong. I mean, it's a lot. And I know that big cities have ping pong clubs. They're kind of a popular thing. So I started Googling all of those and looking at them. And I started thinking about a bigger game room that would have, let's say our floor space was double. Like, let's say we bought the place or leased the place next to ours. You know, half of it would be poker, but the other half would be ping pong and cornhole and chess. We get a pretty decent amount of chess going in our room. Not a lot, but a decent amount. But I don't think those games would draw enough people to pay for doubling our floor space. I just think it would be really fun to have a room like that.
Starting to sound like, I never actually went to the Mayfair Club, but the way I've heard that described, you know, just sort of a games club of which, you know, poker was one, but you know, backgammon also was very prominent there and a few other places.
Yeah. Well, and part of the Oregon, the social gaming ordinance is that we have to offer more games than just poker. So we have a chess table, we have a foosball table, we have a ping pong table. But I just was really struck by how popular ping pong is. And I know there are cities that have big ping pong clubs, but I'm guessing it's kind of like a pool hall. If you're right in downtown and everybody's walking around where they can go, hey, let's go in here and play ping pong for a while, it could probably be successful. But being kind of away from downtown like we are, I don't think it could work. I just like the idea.
What about bridge?
Oh, see, that'd be cool. And in fact, I should be putting a little effort to seeing if we get if we have any bridge players that want to play on a regular basis. You know, we don't open till 5 p.m., so we got card tables that are sitting there with nothing going on until then. We really need to find a use for those.
All right. That's someday when we can all make it to Oregon to a Thinking Poker meetup. Don't worry, we tip. It's okay.
Hey, if you're happy to pay the door fee and buy something to drink, then you're good to go.
You told me a story when I was there about, and I kind of forget the details, so you'll have to refresh my memory, but you ended up testifying, I think, before the Oregon Assembly or whatever it's called.
Yeah, so there was a bill that was introduced in the House to change the social gaming ordinance, and it would effectively close rooms like ours. And so they had the House committee had a public comment. What do you call that? They had a day for public comments, and I went over and spoke for that. But we really weren't very well organized, and it passed in the House, and it went to the Senate. And then the rooms in Oregon got pretty well organized, and so we had, in the public comment section, we probably had 15 people who spoke, both regular players and poker room owners. And we probably had, I remember the committee chair saying, geez, why is the room full today? And his assistant or whatever said, oh, it's House Bill 62 or whatever it was. And he goes, well, let's put that at the top of the docket because that's why all these people are here. So basically, we had a really good showing of poker players. My personal opinion is the bill died in committee. I think it's going to come up again at some point in time. And the reason it died is because it was pretty clear. Nobody on that committee had any experience with poker, and really gambling in general. And the one thing they had to say is, wow, these people really like their poker rooms.
Yeah.
And we're not all the complaints that are supposedly happening. Like I, at the Senate, part of my time I used to make comments about the concerns that were brought up in the House. And one of the concerns that was brought up was that drug dealing and prostitution was happening in these rooms. And when I mentioned that, the entire room broke out laughing. Because, you know, I mean, look at the people in our room, Andrew. Is there a lot of drug dealing and prostitution going on in there? You know, it's
not of the illegal variety, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, they're, the marijuana industry is a pretty big part of the poker rooms in Oregon, that's for sure. But, so, yeah, it's... I mean, the ordinance was written where it has things in it, like you can't include games like, what was it, Klondike? There was another one. It's like, wow, I've never even heard of these games. So yeah, it was written a long time ago and it's not well written. It's not, and because it's so vague, it's kind of allowed for the poker rooms that we have to spring up. And it'd be really good. I mean, I hate to, it's kind of a sleeping horse thing. It's, or maybe sleeping bear is a better analogy. I mean, if Oregon may decide, hey, we don't want to have these poker rooms. But if they decide they want to have them, then we should have rewrite the ordinance so it's more fitting for what's currently happening. Yeah. But it was an interesting experience. I mean, going to those committee meetings was, the whole thing was interesting.
I will say, at least like 10 or 15 years ago, there was a site. Like a website that would link you to each state's relevant ordinances about either gambling or charity gambling.
Yeah,
and it's nice. And it makes wonderful bathroom reading because none of it makes sense. It's all silly. Like in Michigan, if it's like a crane, if it's like a money and like the prize, like there are like regulations on like the size of the crane. And like, yeah, it's just delightful. And they're all super old. So like, you know how the Georgia state income tax, like there are all these tiers and like, you know, if you make up to $200 a year, you pay this much and then $300. So like there are all these brackets, but most of the brackets are close to zero just because like it's so outdated. Hat tip to the listeners who have told me about this, who live in Georgia. And it's just delightful and old fashioned. It's great fun. Really good bathroom reading. I recommend it. Also in some places, you can do different things. The rules on what you can do to collect a gambling debt are different if you're the one who originally got the debt or if you bought it from somebody else. So, like, fun fact. I didn't know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I believe in Portland, and I can't say I know this for sure, but I'm pretty sure there are things that says you can't bet more than a dollar. And so that is part of why. So in Portland, they can only run tournaments. And just from afar reading all that, I go, okay, that's why they're doing tournaments. Because when you bet, you're not even betting money. You're betting tournament chips. And so, yeah, it's a little silly to say, well, you can have poker games, but you can't bet more than a dollar.
Well, right, because I think, like, and I think the history there is, like, the rule use, like, at one point in prehistory, the rule is there's no poker. Then... you know, a senior citizen's home has a weekly poker game and people play for pennies. And then the cops get mad at somebody in the game, so they go in and break it up. And then everybody says, like, oh, man, you're, like, punishing these poor senior citizens who are just trying to, like, you know, have pleasant retirements and bet their pennies and do something, you know, pleasant and intellectually productive. And so they pass a law. It's like, okay, you can have poker, you just can't bet more than a buck, okay?
Right.
But then a bunch of yahoos like us realize that they accidentally legalized poker tournaments, so we go gamble for a lot of money.
exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right on the money.
It seems like actually, I mean, I imagine it was sort of a hassle and maybe give you some heartburn feeling like your business was potentially on the chopping
block?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. 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 we were very motivated.
Sorry, go ahead. Finish here.
Well, we were very motivated to do whatever we could to stand up for ourselves. I mean, it really... it was your classic situation of a group of people who don't know you, have never been to the poker room, are going to make decisions about it. And they don't even know poker and haven't been to any of their poker rooms. And so our local, I think he was the House, I apologize, I can't remember if he's the senator or the House representative. He met with us, and I took four of our other players, and we all met with him at one time, and he was, I give him a lot of credit. He was very open to hearing what we had to say. He had concerns. We addressed them at the end of the meeting, and we met for quite some time. He let us know where he stood, which was that he would be on our side, which was awesome. So yeah, the whole experience was interesting. We spent a lot of time and a lot of effort on it. We also came up with all the loopholes that we could use if they did change the ordinance. So for example, one of the things was they were going to make it where you could no longer charge an entrance fee. And of course, without rake and that kind of thing, there, you have to charge an entrance fee or you're not charging anything. We were going to charge $8 for a bottle of water. It was totally optional, but we asked every player when they entered the room to buy a bottle of water for $8. You know, so it's that kind of thing. Instead of approaching it and really handling the issue, which is what I think the legislature should do, they were just going to shoot off new rules, and we were going to find ways around those rules. So fortunately, it didn't happen. We just ended up, the bill died, and life continued as we already knew it.
And what kind of taste did that leave in your mouth? I mean, did you end up feeling sort of subject to the whims of an arbitrary authority, or did you feel like, hey, I actually was heard as a citizen, like a thing? I mean, because it kind of sounds to me like ultimately it worked the way it's supposed to, you know, like you showed up, you testified, you got a groundswell of grassroots, you know, your patrons to come and testify on your behalf. You were heard and the right decision was made.
Yeah, I think it's the latter, but there's a couple things in the process that are just make me grind my teeth a little bit. For example, the bill was introduced, was put forward. There's a new casino that is built in Washington State, right over the river from Portland. And they were behind this bill. And in essence, they found somebody to introduce a bill in order to try to close all the rooms in Portland so that all the poker players would have to drive over the bridge and play at their casino. And the one thing that I found very irritating is in Oregon, if you introduce a bill in the House, you don't have to attach your name to it. So we don't even know who introduced the bill. So piecing it together, I'm assuming this casino made a donation to some politician who introduced the bill, and we have no idea who it was. And that's just fundamentally wrong, in my opinion.
I guess we keep tying this back to politics, but you know, I feel much the same way, and I guess I told you guys this in person as well, but your room, so for one thing, it's the first like poker small business I've really interacted with. I mean, maybe to some degree, like Lucky Chances in San Francisco is not part of a big conglomerate, I think, but that's it's more complicated. It's a much bigger place. You know, like most poker rooms are attached to casinos, which are themselves part of, you know, larger casino chains, and the idea of like a mom and pop poker room, that by itself I think is quite neat. But then on top of that, it feels much to me like going into a pot shop in Oregon or in Nevada, where it's a thing that at least traditionally, has been kind of associated with vice, or in some people's minds might have some kind of seedy reputation. But when you actually go there and see the place, as you were emphasizing, it feels not remotely seedy. You're sort of like, well, yes, of course this place should exist. Like, this is just a group of nice people who have a hobby in common, and they want to come together and do their hobby together and have fun and, you know, drink a beer while they're doing it.
Right. And I agree 100%, obviously. And my speech that I give every chance I get is, if you take up golf as a hobby and you pay $60 a round and you play 3 days a week, everybody says, what a great hobby. But if you play a poker tournament 3 days a week and it's $60 to enter the tournament, people are going to say, oh my God, how much money did you lose? And, you know, poker's a hobby that requires having some disposable income. And, you know, it's no different than playing golf or going skiing or any other expensive hobby.
Do you still play yourself, or is that like a busman's holiday?
Oh, I play as often as I can, which is not very often. I love to play poker. And I guess I always thought that it was really important with poker to play a little less than you want to, so you always want to. And so I guess I'm in that position. But I play sometimes at the end of the night, you know, it'll be like five people I've known for more than 10 years, and they'll say, hey, Paul, why don't you come over and play with us? So sometimes I play with friends, you know, the last 30 or 40 minutes of the night. And I try to go out of town once a month and play tournaments somewhere else. So next month I'm going to a tournament series that's held at a casino on the coast.
Is that for fun, or do you feel some kind of professional obligation to kind of keep up with what other places are doing?
Oh, both. Yeah, it's really valuable to go to these other places and, you know, see what's happening. I can't, you know, when a floor ruling is going to happen, I'm the one person at the table who's really excited. I want to see what, you know, how they're going to handle it, and, you know, that kind of stuff. So, and just procedure on running tournaments. I try to have consistency with the rest of the poker industry for the reason I mentioned before. So when our players go somewhere else, they feel totally comfortable and, you know, they know what's going on. Occasionally it'll come up, somebody will say, hey, we should have a rule that you can do this or you can't do that. And my answer always is, and we do have a couple specific rules to the room, but my answer is, I don't want to be the room where they go, oh, you should see the rule poker rules they have over this room. Yeah, so we try to be really consistent with those couple exceptions, with standard rules everywhere.
We've taken about as much of your time as we had said we would, but it's been a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I think our listeners will like it, and, you know, best of luck with your business.
Well, thank you very much, Nate. It's nice to meet you. Maybe I'll get a chance to run into you at the World Series.
I would very much enjoy that. It's meals on me if you do.
How soon are you going to be 50? Because that's when I play.
WSOP 2033.
There you go. Well, I'll see you in.
hope we're at the same table.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I'd recognize the voice, I think that.
Fantastic. Take care.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks again, Paul.
The devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.